Susan Hailing on behalf of the United States. I will start with back at the beginning with the juror bias issue. In this case, the judge did not commit clear error in finding Mr. Hatow credible. And that's clear from what's on the record and what took place in this case. Here is a juror who came in, who was asked to come in. There is no evidence whatsoever that he knew what was going on before he was asked to come in to testify. He was asked to testify. When it was determined at the hearing that there was going to be testimony from him, the government was instructed not to speak to him, and they did not. There is no evidence that he knew at all what this was about. It makes perfect sense that he consulted an attorney before being called in to testify under oath. But there's no evidence whatsoever that he was informed of what the issue was.
So Ms. Hailing, I have to say, I mean, clear isn't the word I would use for this point. If what Mr. Hatow had said during voir dire, way back when, you know, at the beginning, was, I've had a lot of problems with gangs in my where my business is located, and I've had constant problems with broken windows, and I've had MLDN graffiti sprayed all over the wall, and so on. At a minimum, defense counsel would have followed up on that, and since it happens to be that very gang that was in paragraph 2 of the government's indictment, it's not inconceivable to me that the district court might have said, I'll grant a challenge for cause. So if we go back to the very beginning, if he said, you know, I really hate the ML, the maniac Latin disciples, surely the judge would have done that. So we're in a question of degree here.
I understand. And I guess what I would suggest is that we look at what the question was asked to the juror. He was asked, you will hear evidence in this case about alleged involvement of street gangs. And will this evidence affect your ability to be fair and impartial juror in this case? I think it's very reasonable that would not trigger in somebody's mind that 7 years ago, at that time it was 7 years ago, that he had erected a barrier and vandalism started in that area. I mean,
but he gets the graffiti apparently 6 months before the hearing, which would be what, about 4 months before the trial. It's current events.
And Judge, I disagree with defense counsel that it's apparent from those pictures that it's MLDN and a pitchfork.
Oh, it looks like it to me.
But even if you want to say that it is absolutely clear that it's MLDN and a pitchfork, this is a man at that point, when he's asked this question, has no knowledge of the MLDs. And it's not as if there's evidence.
How do you know that? Does he say, I've never heard of the MLDs?
When he's testifying at the post-trial hearing, he says he has no knowledge of street gangs. So, I mean, how you would know what graffiti goes along with a street gang if you have no knowledge of street gangs, I'm not sure. As well as, it's not as if, you know, that's... You have to look at what was in his mind when he was asked that question. It's before even this 2-month trial. But even during trial, it's not as if the government presented evidence of, here's the graffiti that MLD puts out there, and it's MLDN with a pitchfork, and it looks just like this. That wasn't the case.
No, I understand that. I mean, but it's troublesome. You know, it's like saying, you know, I've never heard of Brown versus Board of Education. I mean, most people who watch TV or read newspapers or anything have some passing familiarity with the fact that there are street gangs in America's major cities, and they might even know some of the names of the street gangs. And so for him to get up there and say, I've never heard of it, is troublesome. And then for him, after the trial, to try to go and reach out to the prosecutors, he sounds like a man on a mission.
Judge, you know, I think if you put it into context of, here's somebody who spent 2 months of their life in front of these people, and he was the foreperson of the jury. You know, what was in his mind? Why did he want to talk to us afterwards? You know, I don't know. I mean, I would be speculating, and that's the thing. That's what everybody. I mean, if we take that as that means he's biased. We're simply speculating. What we need to look at is what he testified to under oath. What the judge is looking at.
Well, and what he didn't testify. I mean, the whole problem is what he didn't say, right? He conceals all of this experience he has with gangs.
Not when he's questioned about it.
Back during the voir dire, he conceals it. He doesn't answer 11 or 12 with any details.
My response to that is, it's not an answer to question 11. What question 11 asks is, will this evidence affect your ability to be fair and impartial? And he's saying, no, it will not. And he's always said that. And what he is explaining in the post-trial hearing, there's nothing that contradicts that says, you know, yes, I am biased, but I'm hiding it. There's nothing about that. He is unequivocal, I mean, to use Mr. Blagan's word, he's unequivocal during the post-trial hearing that in his mind it was a gang of kids who did this. I mean, that's what he's saying. And if we, why should we sit back now when the district court was sitting there listening to this, knew all the stuff that what Mr. King's proffer was, listened to the evidence of Mr. Hatow, saw him in person, looked him in the eye, and thought all his answers were credible. To now second guess that without anything concrete to say it was a lie when you said you could be fair and impartial, there's not a basis for saying it was a lie. So the first point is that there was not a lie to the question. And, you know, with regard to question 12, I think it's a couple of reasons about bringing it up in the reply brief. One is I think that there's no reason it couldn't have been brought up in the opening brief, okay? Certainly they had time to scour the record and bring it up. But beyond that, I think what it shows is that it really is a non-issue. I mean, to say that answer is now that his answer means he's a member of a group. You know, I was on the street the other day with my neighbors talking about the fact that somebody entered their house. And so three of us were talking about how a car had been stolen on our street and a couple other things. Does that make me a member of a group? I think not. I think it's kind of ridiculous to say that that should have been an answer to number 12. And I think that that's the reason why it was never brought up before. So I think there's just nothing in the record to show that his answer, that I can be fair and impartial, is a lie. But beyond that, I don't think that even if he were to have brought up the issue of this graffiti and the broken windows and on his building, that would necessarily mean that he should be excused for cause. Truly, it would be remarkable how many people would be excused for cause if vandalism and living or having a business in a low, you know, a high crime rate would excuse them for cause.
How close a link to this particular gang do you think there would have to have been before a challenge for cause would have been appropriate?
Well, I think the question assumes that there is even somewhat of a link to this gang. I still put forth that I don't think it's clear, and at least it certainly wasn't clear in Mr. Hatow's mind, that said MLDN pitchfork and that referred to the MLDs.
Well, I mean, we have the pictures of what the wall looked like in the record, and I have to say, I mean, just looking at it myself, it looks pretty clear that it says MLDN and the pitchfork, but maybe he didn't translate it, I don't know. But I'm just saying, what would have been enough if he had said, you know, they left a flyer on my front step saying, you know, the maniac Latin disciples are going to make life terrible for you, you know, or something. I mean, I don't know. What would it have been?
Well, I think, first of all, it would be in conjunction with his answer of whether he could be fair and impartial. I mean, it would have to be looked with regard to that. But, I mean, if you look at some of the cases, for instance,
we always take at face value somebody, as soon as they recite the words, I'll be fair and impartial, it doesn't matter what other evidence there is?
No, absolutely not. I'm just saying that's part of it. I mean, it depending on how he answered that as well. But if you look at some of the case law where they talk about, you know, cases, a person being a victim of similar circumstance and things like that, there are people who either themselves or a relative had the exact same circumstances going on. I mean, this case was not about vandalism or broken windows. This is a case about a drug conspiracy of crack cocaine being sold on the street corners day in and day out, using violence to protect their street corners. And that is just not even remotely close to what Mr. Hatow was experiencing. So in this case, I'd say it's just not even close. I mean, I suppose if he had been held up and somebody had, you know, MLD on their chest and he knew it was MLD gang members, you know, then, you know, and they had a gun, it's getting obviously closer to what the circumstances of the case are. But in this case, there's just a wide, you know, a huge variation from what he was experiencing to what this case was about. You know, and I'll move on. Unless there's any other questions about the juror bias issue. With regard to Mr. Hernandez, Mr. Hernandez, the evidence showed that Mr. Hernandez and his family members ran the Rockwell and Potomac section. The
government's, Mr. Hernandez's lawyer, Mr. Duesberger, says that your evidence is really old about that and that it's not so clear. And it certainly does seem to be pretty clear that the intercepted calls that you're relying on are about marijuana.
Well, I'll give you an example of a call that is clearly about cocaine. On March 11th, 1999, it's transcript line 5, 1468. Hernandez asks Mr. Ross, "I want a 4.5 of that cooked up rice." Okay, I don't know how, you know, based on the evidence that came out of trial of what cooked up means and 4.5 being 4.5 ounces, I don't know how much clearer that could be as a request for 4.5 ounces of crack cocaine. Now, Mr. Hernandez's lawyer suggests, well, that doesn't matter because Ross said he didn't have it at the time. Well, we all know that is certainly can be used as evidence of conspiracy when he's trying to get crack cocaine from Mr. Ross. So the other thing that Mr. Duesberger is trying to do is to cut out little pieces of the evidence and look just at that and not at the whole of the evidence. Because when at the post-arrest statement, Mr. Hernandez says, "My family is Rockwell. Rockwell and Potomac is my family." And when Mr. Ross on tape says that the zone is Bum and those other guys, Bum being Juan Hernandez, what he's not connecting is that there's cooperator testimony about what's going on at Rockwell and Potomac, that crack cocaine is being sold on a daily basis at that corner.
So what's the government's theory, really, of and segregating David Hernandez from Juan Hernandez, I think, is important here. But what's your theory about the role that Juan Hernandez plays in this conspiracy? Not very much buying, apparently.
I would completely disagree with that characterization.
Well, what's the evidence that there's more buying than the one effort to get cooked up rice?
And it's listed out in the government's brief. It's on March 6, 1999. Before I go through these calls, let me step back for a second. Mr. Duesberger seems to suggest that if Mr. Hernandez is buying marijuana from Mr. Ross, that somehow makes him not part of this conspiracy. Well, right in the indictment, it's charged crack cocaine, and marijuana. So to single out and say, to go along with what Mr. Duesberger says, which I do not, but even if we were to go to assume that what he's saying is true, that this only involved marijuana, marijuana is charged in the conspiracy. So I don't know how that gets him out of being a member of the conspiracy when at least, you know, I can recite these sites. March 6, 1999, line 5908, he asked for 25 cents. Now, 25, it could be a reference to marijuana or to cocaine, but, you know, give Mr. Duesberger the benefit of the doubt, and we'll say it's marijuana. The next day, line 5, 10, 13, he wants two TVs that he got yesterday. And then March 18th.
What's a TV? Actually, I have two vocabulary things. What's a TV first?
The government would. It's our position that is drugs, and I'll explain why. Because the call the next day on line 5, 1107. Well, let me explain. The first call, when he's talking about the 25 cents, he says his mother-in-law needs 25 cents. 2 days later on March 8th, line 2, 1107, he says, "Remember what I got from my mother-in-law?" And Ross says, "Oh, yeah, half and a quarter," which are clearly drug quantities. So it's now clearing up what he meant by the 25 cents 2 days before. And sandwiched in there, a day in between, he's asking for two TVs that he got yesterday. So I'd say that is good evidence that what he's trying to do is purchase drugs from Ross.
I know, but I just want to know. I mean, sometimes, you know, to take a very simple example,
yeah.
Weed, marijuana, everybody knows that. TV, is that cocaine, crack,
and
some weird other thing?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. What I suggest is it could be either one.
But why should we assume it's a drug? I mean, you know, we just don't know.
Because the next day when he says, "Remember what I got from my mother-in-law? A half and a quarter," which are clear drug quantities. Now, whether it's marijuana or cocaine, I don't know. But he's so then you know what he's talking about 2 days before when he says 25 cents, because he asked, he said, my mother-in-law needs 25 cents. So you're clearing up that that's a drug thing as well. And then when he says two TVs, what I got yesterday when he asked for the 25 cents. So they're clearly talking about drug quantities. It's whether it's marijuana or cocaine, I don't know the answer to that. The
okay.
others
Can
are
I
clear.
Can I ask you about my other vocabulary
sure.
thing?
Mm-hmm.
This is, I'm sure, a sign that I'm still naive in the cocaine business or something, but the term throw line is used repeatedly through all of these briefs and as some sort of thing that gangs do all the time, and if you're in the throw line, it's obvious that you're using the MLD organization to do it. And I don't know exactly what a throw line is. I can sort of hypothesize, but what is it?
It's simply a group of guys that are standing out on a street corner that are organized in the sense that they take turns selling the drugs.
They just rotate around who's a lookout and who's
exactly.
sitting there.
Exactly. And it's not that one person can just keep selling their drugs. They have to take turns, and the next customer that comes up gets to the next person.
Okay. And what's so unique about gangs for that? Or what inference about this conspiracy or gangs or anything else should we draw from the fact that this is done in a throw line?
Nothing other than that there's structure and organization to getting these drugs sold. It's not just everybody taking their drugs and just running off and doing whatever they're going to do with them. It is a controlled environment where they and structured, and that there are rules to be followed. And the point of it is to get these drugs out as fast as they can. And if they do it in this controlled way and they have security out there and somebody who's taking a turn to hold, hold a gun and watch out for rival gangs and police, they're going to accomplish more. Mm-hmm. Let me just wrap up with Mr. Hernandez. So he's clearly, even if you didn't want to take what inferences, and I say inferences loosely because it's evidence, it's out there. It's just, I think what Mr. Hernandez's lawyer wants is somebody to sit up on the stand and say, I saw Mr. Juan Hernandez doing this, on this date, day in and day out, rather than what the evidence will show is through varying different people and different calls that he is, he and his family are running the Rockwell Potomac section, and here's what's going on with that. But even if you want to put that aside, just the calls with Ross clearly show that he has, he's part of this conspiracy. He's getting, he's got a prolonged relationship with Ross. It's not user quantity, it's large quantities of drugs. Even if a lot of, most of the calls talk about marijuana, he's still asking for 4.5 ounces of crack cocaine. He gets drugs on credit from Mr. Ross. Clearly in one call, one line, line 5, 3820, he says to Ross, I'm just going to grab it, sell it, and then I'll give you the money. Clearly stating he's getting the drugs fronted from Ross. His post-arrest statement admits that he was getting marijuana fronted by another MLD member. They have a standardized way of doing business. In one call, he sets up a meeting with one of Ross's workers, Mr. Cortez, and Cortez says, "Let's do this the same way we always do it." He's using code words. He uses broccoli. He uses says, "My mother-in-law wants the 25 cents, the two TVs." And in addition, there's an extremely high level of trust between Mr. Ross and Mr. Hernandez that's displayed in the calls. On line 5, 1455, Mr. Ross says to Juan Hernandez, "Why don't you try to push some of them for me? Why don't you try to see if you can get some people?" And I say people, that wasn't the word he used, but that want about 10 or 20 of these somewhere. He's trying to get Mr. Hernandez to sell more and to get his people to sell more. Another example is when Mr. Hernandez calls Mr. Ross to tell him that the police are out everywhere, and he said, tells Mr. Ross to be careful. All of this showing all the elements and the different factors that are looked at to determine whether he's a conspiracy. They all exist. So even you don't even have to get to the stuff that is talked about by the cooperators and other evidence that shows that he's actually even leading some of the sections throughout the time period of the conspiracy. With regard to Mr. Chambers.
So But Mr. Chambers is the one who's not an MLD member.
That's correct, right? Your Honor.
And Mr. Chambers is the one with a very low amount of drugs attributed to him.
Correct. Typically. If the case law were, as Mr. Tunick was trying to suggest that, and I'm not saying that Mr. Tunick was trying to suggest that the case law is this, but what his argument was look at Mr. Chambers in comparison to everybody else. But that's not the standard that we look at to see if there's sufficiency of the evidence of somebody being part of the conspiracy. And the factors that we do look at are all part, Mr. Chambers, they all show that Mr. Chambers was part of the conspiracy. For instance, the time frame that he's involved in this, it's exactly what Your Honor had said, it's set forth in our brief about that at least Chambers and Ross had a relationship beginning December 1998, as testified by Stacy Dalton, who was getting her drugs from Mr. Chambers, and Mr. Chambers admitted to her that he was getting them from Mr. Ross, to the time period when the drug ledger is found in June of 1999, and he's owing Mr. Ross at that time. These drug and
maybe you could talk about the drug, the so-called drug ledger,
sure,
for a little bit, because as I understand, I mean, it's in the record. As I understand, it's just a bunch of names with numbers next to them, and to extrapolate from that that the numbers represent debt levels, and it's like a constant forever debt level, or there are pages ripped out, or there. How can you draw the inference it's a particular debt level?
Well, for instance, And I'm sorry that this is not in the brief, but in the transcripts, in the trial transcripts, there is, it's Jose Aguirre's testimony. He talks about drug transactions that he did, this one having to do with amounts of marijuana that he was getting, and those are tied up into the drug ledger, and you can actually see the calculations and are equivalent to what he was talking about. So I'd say that is very strong evidence that this is dealing with drugs. In terms of the time period, it's, you know, I think that...
I mean, it seems like those numbers would change, you know, if not day to day, then week to week.
Absolutely.
As time goes on.
And what I would put forth is that this drug ledger, I mean, I think if it had... I don't know if they were new ledgers or if they just started a system. I would just be speculating. But there were only several pages of this stuff. And I would suggest, had this gone on farther, that's exactly what we would see. Now, whether he started a new notebook and we couldn't find the old notebooks that had this stuff in it, or he all of a sudden decided, you know what, I better start writing these figures down so that I, you know, can make sure what people are saying, I don't know. I mean, I think those are all potential reasons of why there wasn't extensive recordings, you know, that would have covered the years that he was supplying.
But were there alternative explanations offered as to the meaning of the numbers? You know, like house addresses or phone numbers or pagers or anything?
There were people's names and then the figures. And like I said, in Mr. Aguirre's testimony that regarding a sequence of purchases that corresponded to what
right.
was in the
so,
ledger.
So the number 2750, you know, after a name couldn't have meant that you lived at 2750 Damon, you know, or something.
There certainly wasn't evidence of that brought out or anything that I'm aware of that where it corresponded to something other than I can tell you this, there were no figures that appeared to be phone numbers. They were not in a sequence that, you know, say of seven numbers or any dashes in between or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to, just back to the quantity of for Mr. Chambers, I would definitely differ, and as we mentioned in our brief, that 200 grams of crack, even if it is limited to that is a small quantity. A user quantity is 0.2 grams of crack cocaine. 200 grams is substantially more than that, as well as he's buying 4.5 ounces at a time of crack cocaine. Again, very large amounts. And, you know, just as we mentioned in our brief, if you just go to the sentencing guidelines, 200 grams of crack is the third highest level of drugs. So I would suggest that is a large amount of drugs.
But that may not be the best argument, since we've had lots of discussions about marginal deterrence in the sentencing guidelines, you know, and by the time you hit 200 grams, which is nothing, you figure 2.2 pounds to a kilo, 200 grams isn't that much.
I understand. I think it might be our skewed view of that we see these drug quantities all the time, that we think that, you know, it has to be this incredible level. But I would suggest, compared to what a user amount is, it is a highly large amount of crack cocaine. These drugs were sold on credit. Mr. Chambers is in the ledger owing Ross $1,175. He also, in a call line 5, he tells Ross that he owes him $200. And there's also, there's a high-level mutual trust and stake in this illegal venture. They talk about a person who was picked up, they believe, by the federal police, and what they're going to do about it, and how that they need to be concerned about this. And then, you know, most telling, I think, is that Mr. Chambers tells Ross that he's going to be selling to guys at the Zone, which is Rockwell and Potomac, and we clearly know what Mr. Ross is feeling about when people who are not gang members come and try to sell on his corner. So, and then just the standardized dealing in that he repeats orders. He says, you know what I hollered about at you about last time over at Jessica's house? I need that for tonight. They don't need to talk about amounts. They know what they're talking about. And I think that all goes to show that he is clearly a member of the conspiracy. If you compare him to other people, is he as, you know, involved in this as other people? No, but that's not the standard that we look at when trying to see whether he's a member of the conspiracy.
I mean, we hear a very similar argument from, I think it's Rodriguez, who's in prison most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And there you have all this, again, this lingo, you know, clocking with somebody and a blessing and all of those things.
Correct, Judge. But it's not unreasonable for a juror to take the inferences that means that they are going to be working drugs together. And that's the point of it.
It depends what other evidence. I mean, oftentimes the government will have a witness who will decode these kinds of things for the jury. Did you do that?
Certainly, yes. With regard to a lot of the words that are being used, did we do clocking? No, that was not discussed. Is there anything else on those arguments I can address before going on to Pittman's argument?
Okay. And you might mention, you know, in passing, this scope of the conspiracy argument that mm-hmm. the defendants have raised, you know, MLD conspiracy, Ross conspiracy, some combination of the two. I mean, what exactly is your view of the conspiracy that you were trying to prove?
That this is a drug conspiracy involving all of the defendants, that the defendants used the structure and organization of the MLD gang to get these drugs sold. And you know,
I mean, such as it was, because it seems that the evidence at trial indicated that this wasn't really a well-oiled machine.
Correct. But the indictment never said that either. I mean, you can have disagreements and fights within an organization. I mean, that happens quite frequently. It doesn't mean that they're not still using each other and having the structure of the throw lines and the security being used and stuff like that to get those drugs on the street. That's the point of it. I mean, I suppose if we, you know, had elaborated in the indictment of this, you know, this amazing, you know, hierarchical structure that existed, and that's not what we were able to prove. Maybe they'd have an argument of variance, but that was never set forth that is what it was. And I don't mean to reiterate your comments, but it's exactly what it is. The next line of the indictment is exactly what it is. It's that Thomas Ross, by the late 1990s, was the major supplier of this conspiracy. That's how it was set forth. It was how it was set forth in Santiago proffer. It's how the evidence came in. That would be the government's position on that. With regard to Mr. Pittman's motion, I think Your Honor was absolutely correct in the questions that you were asking. I think the district court inquired. Mr. Pittman made a decision that he didn't want to testify and then changed his mind later on. But unfortunately, for Mr. Pittman, that's just not how you know, the system works, is that you've got an opportunity, a time to do that, to make that decision. And, you know, I think that certainly there are defendants in cases that regret or want to change their decision, but that's not, you know, how we can efficiently make this system run. And looking at the factors that we should look at in terms of whether Judge Gettleman abused his discretion, without a doubt, this would have definitely had a huge effect on Judge Gettleman's schedule and what would have happened had he testified, let alone the great distortion of importance I think it would have put on his testimony coming out after this long break. But even with regard to those, you do have to look. I mean, this is a defendant's right to testify, which is a very important right. But, you know, as we can see from the Peterson case, you have to weigh that against the fact that this testimony, you know, there's you know, evidence that this testimony would have had very little value for two reasons. The defense counsel stated on the record that there were going to be portions that he would not be able to ask Mr. Pittman because of ethical obligations. But even beyond that, which is what they had in the Peterson case, even beyond that, here we have a transcript of his prior testimony that would have implicated him greatly into the...
Right. I wanted to actually, while we're on the subject of Pittman and that transcript, comment. I was very disturbed at the concept that this transcript, which really was out of line as it came in, or at least Judge Gettleman thought that, and seems hugely prejudicial. So he gives the he tells the jury, you know, I'm striking the whole thing, don't think about it. But then he says, if this were a 4-day trial, maybe I would declare a mistrial. And that actually bothers me. It seems to me that, you know, what's that? If it's a really long trial, you don't get justice because everybody can't be bothered to give you, an objective trial. It really seems quite inappropriate. Now, this is apart from Mr. Pittman's decision. Certainly, if he'd taken the stand and if he had said something inconsistent with that transcript, that's a whole different situation, but it never arose.
Trying to get into the mind of Judge Gettleman, let me just suggest that maybe what he meant was that in a 4-day trial that wouldn't have had all this evidence, gang evidence, that was reiterated in this statement. I mean, maybe that's what he was referring to, and said it in a shorthand way. I don't know what was in his mind when he said that, but that's a possibility. Here we are in a lengthy trial dealing with all this evidence about what was going on with this gang, what they were doing, the drugs that they were selling, the violence that they were committing. And here is a transcript that's coming in that is corroborating that. Now, not with the particular defendants that are sitting there. Okay,
well,
none
yes,
of them
yes
are
and no, he thought. I mean, I know the government made that argument that their names don't actually come up, but it creates an unbelievable base for the rest of the government's case that there is, in fact, this elaborate organization of the MLDs, and they're into all these things, and they're just now carrying it forward through the next decade. And he says, you know, well, if it were a 4-day trial, maybe he's clearly on the brink of a mistrial. He's deciding yes or no, and obviously there's a lot of investment already in this trial, so he decides not to.
And what I would suggest is the reason he's saying that is because what the statement is just corroboration for what has already come in. It's not as if that evidence hadn't come in. That was out there. It's, you know, if this was, I mean, maybe he's referring to the fact that if it was just, shorter in that this evidence hadn't been in, then it would be a different scenario. With regard back to, Mr. Pittman with saying that, I think I was at a point of saying that his right to testify is very important, but, I was past that. And that has to be looked at with the eye that clearly his defense counsel had concerns about what he was going to testify about, and then the fact that this state transcript would come in that would clearly produce a lot of inculpatory evidence against Mr. Pittman. That being weighed against those, it was not an abuse of discretion for Judge Gettleman to deny his motion to reopen the evidence. Are there any other questions that the judges have?
Apparently not.
Okay.
We thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Do we go back in order to Mr. Blagan, or are you going to shift it around? Okay.
There were just a couple of things that I wanted to point out before I return to the biased juror argument. One is on this issue of the, I think what we styled as a variance between the charge conspiracy and what the government ultimately proved at trial. And Ms. Haling just got done saying, well, we never alleged that the MLDs were a hierarchical structure, that's how they operated. That's exactly what they alleged, and it's exactly what they said in the Santiago proffer. They said the MLDs have a hierarchical structure that governs the drug-selling operation of the gang in the areas controlled by the MLDs. The members of the gang submit to the authority of the organization's ranking officials. And that's exactly what they didn't prove was the hierarchical structure. Returning to... And I also wanted to mention that I think you can take what Judge Gettleman said about the Pittman transcript and look at that when you're deciding the issue of the juror bias and maybe why he didn't want to find that this juror was biased. But returning to that issue, the government made a great deal of the fact that we can't overcome this impossible standard of review. Obviously, it's not an impossible standard. It has been overcome in cases in the past, and it can in this case. More importantly, though... for an issue of implied bias, which we also raised, we get a de novo standard of review. So we don't even have to overcome abuse of discretion. And this court has said that implied bias is where the prospective juror is connected to the litigation at issue in such a way that it is highly unlikely that he or she could act impartially during deliberations. This man was victimized by the very gang he sat in judgment of. And for the government to suggest that that doesn't count because he wasn't victimized in the same way that the same way that the gang was accused of doing things in the indictment is absurd. Of course, nobody tried to sell drugs to Mr. Haytow, and nobody tried to buy drugs from him either. That's what the gang's evidence was about. And even her analogy about, well, if he had been robbed at gunpoint by somebody with MLD tattooed on his chest, there was no allegations in the indictment even about robbery. The only allegations about violence and guns were moving other drug dealers out of spots, not doing anything to citizens or any of that kind of stuff. So I think the analogy doesn't come close to flying, and this is certainly an implied bias case, and you can look at it de novo. With regard to this issue of question 12, I will tell you exactly how it happened. And one of the, you know, there are sometimes uncomfortable things about joint briefs and joint arguments. For example, I was one of the lawyers saying I wanted to leave the courtroom if Mr. Pittman testified. But one of the good things is sometimes you get a separate pair of eyes who wasn't there and maybe focused on the same thing or the wrong thing to look at it. The government's brief indicated, we thought absurdly, that Mr. Haytow testified truthfully in his post-verdict statement. One of the other lawyers, Mr. Morris, reviewed it with an eye towards finding inconsistencies between what he said and what Mr. King said, and there are dozens of them. But he also found this issue relating to the group and the building managers, and that's why it came up then, and that's when it came up. The case I was referring to earlier that I was analogizing to indicate that we don't forfeit it is United States versus Long, 82nd Fed 3rd 81. It's a 1996 case from this circuit, indicating in general that as long as you raise the argument, you don't have to raise each specific point under the argument in order for it to be preserved.
I mean, I just have to say, though, I always look at these things in a fairly practical way, and I ask whether the government would have responded differently if you had raised that. Their brief as appellee is their principal opportunity to respond to the things that the appellants have raised, and that's why a reply is supposed to respond to their arguments, not to put a whole set of new things on the table.
Well, I understand your point, Judge, and I'll confess that I don't have any cases into talking about something that was raised in a reply brief. If memory serves, there are cases, however, talking about something was sufficiently raised when it was raised at oral argument for the first time. So
I
assume
it's a question of assessing what was raised and trying to see whether you're somehow under the umbrella, you know, but maybe yes, maybe no.
I understand. But what certainly isn't the case is that it's the reason it was raised late is because it's somehow a weak argument. It's just one that slipped our attention until later.
I can understand a trial of this magnitude.
Yes. Ms. Haling also said that we're doing a lot of speculating here. For example, speculating as to why Mr. Haytow wanted this meeting with the government. We don't have to speculate. We have two people who tell us why. Mr. King said that Haytow wanted the meeting because he wanted some acknowledgement from the government. Mr. King said he never said it was for the verdict, but we can assume, if we have to speculate a little bit, that that's what he wanted, because during the conversation he said, I was the leader of the group and I was the one responsible for changing the hung jury, words to that effect. Mr. Haytow himself, when he was being cross-examined, said that he wanted to help the government with future cases. That's why he contacted them. He then goes on to equivocate, as I've said before, and says, well, I would have helped anyone with future cases. And the cross-examiner says, well, you didn't call us to help us with future cases. And his answer is, I don't know any of you. As if he somehow knows the government. In his mind, I think, he's friends with the government. That's what he means. Ms. Hayto also said that it would be remarkable how many people would be excused for cause if it was just on this basis. That conclusion can only be reached if you assume that this is a man who just one time had graffiti sprayed on his trash can or something in the back of his house, not someone who dealt for years and for the months during the trial with serious gang problems. That's the kind of person we're talking about, not somebody who would ordinarily have regular contact with gangs.
But I guess I have to say, I mean, this seems to come up in the context, if I remember Mr. Hayto's testimony, of the people in the general area trying to keep the prostitutes out, as I recall, and they built something, and then after that happened, maybe they had the prostitutes out, but at that point there's a rash of window breaking and other kinds of violence. It sounds like a loose connection, if a connection at all, between that and this particular gang. I mean, a lot of citizens are in favor of law and order, right?
Of course. I think if you look at his lengthy, well, maybe it's a two-page diatribe about what was being done to his building and the things he had to do about it, and that his instead of a lawn, he had an area of broken glass instead of grass. I think you'll see exactly what he's talking about, and it's not the ordinary citizen's dealings. But let's turn the government's position on its head. They say it would be remarkable how many people would be excused for cause if we took that. Well, what if a juror, and this has never happened as far as I know, said, I like the Maniac Latin Disciples, and they're all good friends of mine, and I go to parties with them. Is the government suggesting that that wouldn't be a valid challenge for cause for them? Of course it would be. And the opposite is... You know, those kind of analogies don't always work, but I think it does in this case. The government also said that we don't have the same sort of cases where people were victimized by the same sort of crime. And I touched on this a little bit earlier, but I wanted to go back to it. There are a series of cases, all of which, I believe, we have a better case than, and all of them have found implied bias. United States versus Hunley, that's from this circuit. The jurors were burglarized during the deliberations. I spoke about that one earlier. United States versus Polakemi, a jury had worked for the U.S. Attorney's Office and, of course, said that she would not be biased, but the court implied bias. Hayto says, I'm not biased, but he's been victimized by this gang. Burton v. Johnson, a battered woman, sat on a battered spouse defense. Implied bias was found. United States versus Eubanks, jurors' sons were in prison for heroin distribution, and he was sitting in a heroin conspiracy charge. United States versus Alsip, the juror worked in one of the banks that had been robbed by the defendant, not at the time, obviously. United States versus Jackson, the juror had a kind of a personal relationship, a love triangle, similar to the one that was being discussed on trial. Obviously, that's not nearly as severe as what we have here. In United States versus DeVita, the juror was victim of a robbery prior to the trial. All of those found implied bias. We certainly have a case of implied bias here based on what Mr. Hayto said himself and based on what Mr. King told us about what Hayto said in their secret meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Mr. Duesberger.
Just to reply to a few of the things that were said by the government in response. As to the cooked up rice comment, this was a March 11th conversation about a half a pea, which the government admitted was marijuana. During the course of the conversation, Ross said, or Hernandez inquired about cooked up rice. Ross responded, I don't got none. Hernandez replied, okay, all right, okay. And there was no negotiation, no deal, no delivery, and this never came up again between the parties. So I think the cases that this court has decided on these kinds of conversations have said, and frankly I don't have them at my fingertips, there's got to be more than just a comment or something like this, an inquiry that's not followed up on and not discussed any further.
But Mr. Duesberger, your argument has assumed that these few transcripts are the only evidence against Mr. Hernandez. And Ms. Haling said, well, actually, no. You know, they're the cooperating witnesses. There's a lot of other, perhaps more indirect evidence, but other evidence that implicates him.
Well, they weren't able to come up with any in their responsive brief, so I don't know where this evidence is. It's just like what they said at the trial. They overstated the case as to Mr. Hernandez both at the trial and in their brief. And I took their brief, and every single citation that they gave, I opened up the transcript because I would have been surprised to find anything supporting what they said, and there was nothing. Now, I might have missed something, but we have 7 pages in our reply brief showing that Hernandez was not a leader, or at least there was no evidence that Hernandez was a leader. The rest goes to the drugs. There's just no evidence that, you know, is out there somewhere that they keep referring to. And we're contending, it may be alleged in the indictment that marijuana was involved in the conspiracy, so be it, but we're saying that Hernandez was a buyer, a mere buyer, not a conspirator. He did buy marijuana from Ross. There's no doubt about it. But that doesn't necessarily make him part of the conspiracy. And about the 25 cents and the two TV things, we cover that in our individual brief at pages 16 to 17 and 36 to 37 and show that this is part of 3 conversations, all that lead to the one in which there's a bag of weed, meaning marijuana, that is transferred to Hernandez. So at the 25 cents and the two TVs probably talk about marijuana. But the government has the burden of proof. And standing here today, they can't tell you whether these were drugs or actually TVs. And in terms of code words, they mentioned code words. Well, since all these buys from Ross were marijuana, the only key words were the numbers, 2, 25, or 3, or 1. Those were not in code. So they could have been talking about, I'll buy 2 moons, I'll buy 3 cars, and with the, you know, he's buying marijuana.
Need to wrap up, Mr. Okay. Teasberger.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, if you want to just give us a concluding thought, that's fine.
Well, on the drug conspiracy involving Ross, the government said that to the judge at trial, and he denied some motions to sever in the middle of trial, the government said that defendants have to be getting their drugs from Thomas Ross to be part of the conspiracy. That's a direct quote. And they also said selling drugs in a throw line is not enough to make one part of the conspiracy. Hearing that, the judge denied the motions to sever, and in his drug quantity findings, talked about Ross being the centerpiece of the conspiracy as the most important thing.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Tuna?
Your Honor, it's briefly in rebuttal. The problem with the conviction as to my client, Les Chambers, was what happened at the end of the case. In closing argument, the government argued the common scheme was the desire to make profits from narcotics. That's what they argued to the jury as to the common scheme to Les Chambers. I pleaded with the jury not to think of a common scheme as the desire to make profits from narcotics because any person in the city of Chicago who ever purchased from Thomas Ross then is guilty of the conspiracy. And that's not the common scheme. And they never ever elucidate. And even today, they're still talking about throw lines and serving people up on the street, which admittedly the government always admitted Les had no part of. The indictment charged it like that. The Santiago proffer charged it like that. The opening statement charged it like that. It wasn't until closing argument where the government said the common scheme was the desire to make profits from narcotics. And it prejudiced Mr. Chambers incredibly. And the talk about that Mr. Chambers was involved with Ross from December 1998 is not part of the transcripts. The question was between about December of 1998 and February of 1999, where did you get the cocaine that you used? Between December 1998 and February 1999, from Les. You got the cocaine from Les? Yes, I did. Never makes mention of Ross in any way. That's at transcript 2215 and 2216. I ask the court to carefully consider the evidence that was adduced and not to allow the government to say the common scheme is the desire to make profits from narcotics. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Joseph?
The comment the court made about the trial judge comment about this, if this was a four-day trial, may have granted a mistrial. I think the same applies here on Mr. Pittman's issue. I think the judge overemphasized the efficiency of running a complex, long, multi-defendant trial over Mr. Pittman's right to present a defense, specifically over his right to testify in his own defense. The government commented that, well, Mr. Pittman's testimony probably would have had little value. That is not correct. The reason he was moving to reopen the evidence was not to present other third-party witnesses, but himself.
But I was going to ask you, actually, I'm glad you said that, because correct me if I'm wrong, but there is no proffer of any kind. There's nothing in the record that would let us know what Mr. Pittman would have testified to?
That is correct. There is no proffer, but I do not believe that should be fatal to Mr. Pittman's position. His defense at trial was for this decade alleged in the indictment, the 1990s. For most of it, he was in custody, or at some period of time, he was even cooperating with the government, as demonstrated by the fact that he testified for the state. So the things Mr. Pittman would have had testified about are things that he and only he could have testified. And it seemed from the opening statement, from the cross-examination that was being developed, Mr. Pittman's testimony would probably have supported a withdrawal defense from the conspiracy.
That sounds to me like it may be outside or speculative on the basis of the record, since we don't know what he would have testified to. But if you want to just kind of wrap up and let us know what your final thought is, that would be good.
My final thought is, Your Honor, that the jury hung on the last day here. On the last day, they hung on Mr. Pittman on the one count he was charged with, the conspiracy. That tells us that it is possible that had the evidence been reopened and Mr. Pittman allowed to testify, that he could have possibly tipped the jury in his favor. The trial judge here erred by not weighing Mr. Pittman's constitutional right to testify and tipped everything in favor of efficiency.
Okay, thank you very much. And if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Blake and Mr. Duesberg and Mr. Tunick, you were all serving by appointment of the court. We thank you very much for your service, for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your clients. We thank you as well, and we thank you. So this case will be taken under advisement, and we will move on to the second case of today, Triumph Books.